We're going to begin this morning in 1 Samuel chapter 1. If I seemed just a little distracted there at the end, I was because for some reason, as I was driving here this morning, I thought of a city we're gonna come up where that Samuel is from, where Elkanah lives. And there's a little bit of discussion, but verse 1 of chapter 1 says, Ramathim, Zophim. And the best I can tell, that's two options for that. One is that it's Rama. Okay, we'll see that a little bit later on, that they return to Rama. Rama was a town in Benjamin, though. And what does the text clearly say about where Samuel and Elkanah were from? Ephraim. Okay, so I was a little unsure about that. And then as I was driving in, it just kind of, for some reason, I was thinking, is this where, because, you know, and forgive my ignorance and not looking this out. I don't know why it didn't hit me until on the way here this morning. And I thought, well, I can get in class and look it up real quick, but I was unsuccessful. So I'm almost reluctant to throw it out there. But I'm probably wrong. But I was thinking that wasn't this town, because you remember that Saul was anointed twice. One was more of a private anointing, and then, you know, he was publicly anointed there. And I was thinking that one of those two times might have been at this same town, but maybe my brain totally invented that on the way over. I don't know. But I'll have to look that up and get back with you on that. But I didn't say that so that you would spend the class time looking that up. I just said that because I was thinking about that, but let me research that. I'll be teaching again on Sunday. And that just dawned on me on the way here. Is there a connection? But there may not be, so don't hold me to that. So, a couple of things that are maybe odd about starting this morning. One is that, yeah, and please don't look that up during the class, seriously. I know if I were you, that my temptation would be to flip ahead to about 1 Samuel 8, and what was the name of that town? But yeah, I'm not, I'll do that in the week coming. I know that would be my temptation, so I shouldn't have brought it up yet until I thoroughly researched it. So just a couple of things here. One is, last time we were back in Judges, and that's when we finished up the story of Samson. So you'll notice that today we're starting all the way up in 1 Samuel chapter 1. So why is that? Why are we skipping the last part of the book of Judges and also the book of Ruth? So why is that? And the reason is that those stories there are more of appendices. There's the story of Micah and his idol, and the migration of the Danites, and then the story of Ruth. And chronologically, it's almost certain that they don't fit right here. So what we're going to do is go ahead and take the Judges chronologically. So after Samson comes Eli and Samuel. And we're going to cover that kind of chronologically. Then we'll go back, pick up the last part of the book of Judges and the book of Ruth at the end. And that's kind of going to be our approach to this. So we're jumping ahead to 1 Samuel chapter 1. And probably it would be good to do that as you're teaching the class as well. And Bob's book follows that same pattern of doing so. So 1 Samuel chapter 1 is where we're going to start. And so we'll talk a bit about the cities. So again, you know, it's mentioned as Ramathim, Zophim. And in the New Testament, you'll see I've got that labeled as Arimathea here. In the New Testament, I think that a lot of authorities suggest that that city was, in New Testament times, called Arimathea. And you can see that it was in the hill country of Ephraim. And it was off to the west of Shiloh there. So Shiloh is another city that plays a key role in today's story. Now, geography isn't so much of a big deal in today's story. Next Sunday, when we talk about the war with the Philistines, we'll follow the geography a little more closely. But here, the key cities are Arimathea or Ramathim, Zophim. And again, I'm unsure as to whether it was actually Rama, because later on, it says they returned to their house at Rama. Now, Rama was in Benjamin, but notice where Rama was. I mean, it's not like it was way down in the center of Benjamin, right? It was kind of real close to the border between Benjamin and Ephraim. So perhaps You know, Ramah could be the city that Samuel and Elkanah are from. So I don't know about that for sure. But either way, there would have been about the same distance up to Shiloh, where the house of God was in this day. And you'll remember the house of God was placed there in Shiloh in the days of Joshua. We covered that earlier this quarter. And so it's still here in Shiloh. So that's where the story focuses today, is on that geography. So Samuel, am I mistaken about this, or was Samuel a priest? Yes, he was a priest. Did he offer sacrifices? Yes, he did. He did that, and he rebuked Saul later on in the United Kingdom for offering sacrifices instead of waiting on him to get there so that he could offer them. So, but it says, verse 1, that his father was an Ephraimite. So is there an explanation for this, a reasonable explanation? Text says he was an Ephraimite. So was he of the tribe and I think I've got this. I'm explaining here. I got ahead of my slides. Can you believe that? I normally just take, if it's not on PowerPoint, then I don't say it. But apparently today I've maybe... we're going to jump forward. We'll return to the book of Judges later and we'll cover Ruth. So he was from Ramathim Zophim in the mountains of Ephraim. So was Elkanah of the tribe of Ephraim? So if you turn over to 1 Chronicles 6. Now remember in some of my discussions with Bob, you know, as he was drilling me on where things were located in the Bible. One of the things he told me as I was memorizing scriptural limits on certain periods of Bible history, there's a difficulty with 1 Chronicles 1 through 9. And Bob described 1 Chronicles 1 through 9 as those chapters which separate the true Bible student from someone who just knows a little bit about it. So I still fall into the category of someone who just knows a little bit about it. And occasionally I flip back here and put some pieces together. But true knowledge of these nine chapters is not something that I really have. But in 1 Chronicles chapter 6 and verse 26, if you back up to, say, verse 1 of 1 Chronicles 6, the sons of Levi were Gershon, Kohath, and Merari. And then again in verse 16, the sons of Levi were Gershon, Kohath, and Merari. And then if you get up to verse 26, as for Elkanah, the sons of Elkanah were Zophai and so forth. So you'll see that, and then verse 28 mentions Samuel as well. So you'll see that it's clearly talking about the family of Elkanah and Samuel. And they are, verse 22, sons of Kohath. All right? So clearly Elkanah and Samuel are Levites. Right? They are clearly Levites through the clan of Kohath. Okay? So clearly Samuel had the right to be a priest. So why then does chapter 1, verse 1 of 1 Samuel say that he was an Ephraimite? How do we explain this? Go ahead. Okay, good. That's correct. Good, good. Very good, very good. Very good. So Charles mentions Mount Ephraim there in 1 Chronicles 6:64, which is the absolute spot-on correct explanation of this. You remember the Levites didn't get a geographical portion of the land, and we covered that back in the division of the land, right? The Levites got the cities, and it specifically mentions Mount Ephraim. Well, you'll notice in verse 1 that it was Ramathaim Zophim. Well, again, if you look back, Mount Ephraim is not shown on here. But Arimathea or Ramathaim Zophim was actually at the foot of Mount Ephraim is where that was. So there was a mountain called Mount Ephraim and Ramathaim Zophim was at the foot of that. So 1 Chronicles 6:64 mentions specifically that that Mount Ephraim and its suburbs. So perfect, logical, it just dovetails, doesn't it? No contradiction whatsoever. When someone thinks there's a contradiction in the Bible, typically what that means is they haven't studied it. And they haven't seen that indeed the Bible does have more information which completely explains it. And this is one of those the easier ones to explain because you have the information beforehand in the book of Joshua. And you also have this information in 1 Chronicles 6. So definitely, and then even a casual study of geography will suggest that, you know, that it was near Mount Ephraim where Ramathaim Zophim was. It does? Okay, it shows that in the map. Okay. Yeah, and the new one, let me see if I can find it, because I've used that map as reference. It's on page 81, oddly enough, in the new one. I think I have the new one. And yeah, it does. It has Ramathaim Zophim there in the hill country of Ephraim. And that's about where I put it. I'm glad I got it right. Because I didn't use this map. I'm glad I got that right. So yeah, it's there in Ephraim. Good. And again, in the New Testament, that was, I think, called Arimathea. Good. Thanks, Shirley. I appreciate that. Very good. So you had that information on the map in the book as well. All right. So any more thoughts, questions about where Samuel was from, which tribe he was from, and what geography he was from? So he was from the tribe of Levi and the geography of Ephraim. Okay. No doubt about that. And again, the only thing that really causes any confusion there is that later on it's going to say that after being at Shiloh, they returned to Ramah. And I don't really have the explanation for that, because Ramah was in Benjamin. You know, why the difference? Except that perhaps Ramah would be another name for Ramathaim Zophim. That wouldn't be a stretch to me to suggest that. Or that it, you know, it could have been, you know, Ramathaim Zophim could have been in this area as well, which is real close to the border. I think either of those two are acceptable explanations for that. Yeah. Yeah, certainly. Certainly. They could have moved. Definitely. All right. So that's Samuel's father, Elkanah. Anything else about that? So Elkanah had two wives. One was named Peninnah and the other was named Hannah. Peninnah had children, sons and daughters, but Hannah was barren. The text says that the Lord had closed her womb. And every year, so we see that Elkanah was indeed a religious man. And every year they would go to Shiloh to offer sacrifices. And when they did, he would give Peninnah and her children a portion of the sacrifices. But to Hannah, he would give her a double portion of the sacrifices. And so he would, you know, the part that was left, he would divide it up that way because Hannah had no children, but yet he loved her. So he would give her the double portion. Now we see here every year that this happened. And every year what would happen is Peninnah would make fun of Hannah, would provoke her. You see just the ugliness of polygamy there, don't you? I doubt that only happened yearly, that kind of provoking and that kind of thing. But it did happen yearly there in Shiloh. But I would imagine that was probably a part of daily life, was some tension at the least between Peninnah and Hannah there. So just you see that while God tolerated it, it clearly was not His will. And the Bible just matter-of-factly states it and without comment, but you can see the absolute ugliness of it here in this text. So she would make fun of her year by year, and obviously Hannah would become sad because of that. No one likes to be made fun of, and then when you add to that her strong desire to have a son, and so she would weep, and even though she had a double portion, she would weep so much she couldn't eat, and she wouldn't eat. And so Elkanah would try to comfort her, and you know, he would try and try, but he would say things like, "Why are you sad? Am I not better to you than 10 sons? So guys, that's not a way to comfort not a way to comfort your wife. Aren't I better than anything else you could want?" So I don't think that worked. And clearly it didn't work in the case of Elkanah. It did not comfort her at all. And so this one time, on this occasion that's under question here, she left her family and she went into the tabernacle. Now verse 9, someone have a different translation there? Hannah arose after they had finished eating and drinking in Shiloh. Now Eli the priest was sitting on the seat of the doorpost of the tabernacle of the Lord. Does anybody have a different translation for tabernacle of the Lord there? Temple? So you have temples. Anyone ever, a few others see temple? All right. So temple. When was the temple built? And who built it? Solomon. So who comes first? Samuel or Solomon? Or Eli or Solomon? Eli comes way before Solomon, right? About 100 years or so before Solomon. So the word temple there, I think, just meant house of God. And it had been somewhat permanently. I mean, it's been in Shiloh for quite a long time, the tabernacle. But I take it was the tabernacle described in Exodus that was built and set up and really had been there in Shiloh for quite some time. But it was not the temple as in Solomon's day. So that's something to just note there, that don't get confused there. It was indeed, it could have been house of God or palace or temple. But it was most likely the tabernacle, because the temple had not yet been built. So nonetheless, Hannah goes there to the tabernacle to pray, and she's just really distressed. And as she's praying, her lips are moving, but her voice is not being heard. Her lips are moving, and she's praying and asking God earnestly to give her a son. And she even makes a vow and says, "If, Lord, if you'll give me a son, I will give him back to you. No razor will come on his head." What does that mean? We covered that. He'll be a Nazarite from birth, like Samson was. Okay? So we did cover that last time. So that's the vow she makes, and she'll turn him completely back over to the Lord. And Eli is watching this, and he sees her lips moving and can't hear what she's saying. And Eli assumes she's drunk. And he goes and he rebukes her rather sharply and says, "You know, put away your wine away from you. How long will you be drunk?" And Hannah very respectfully, get ahead of myself again. She prayed earnestly, made a vow. Her lips moved. And Eli thought she was drunk and rebuked her. But she very respectfully explains, and I really appreciate the respect that Hannah shows to Eli in this text. Because if someone accused me of being drunk while I was praying earnestly in distress, I'm not sure I would be as respectful as Hannah was. So I admire that, her control of her emotions and her respect of the role that Eli had. And she says, "I am not drunk. Don't think I'm a wicked woman. I haven't had any wine or any intoxicating drink at all. I have poured my soul out to the Lord," is what she says. "And don't consider me a wicked woman." Eli, when he saw that, he accepted her response. And he said, "May the Lord grant what you've asked for. Go in peace." And again, she's very respectful. And she says, "Please let your maidservant find favor in your sight." She went away. And again, I appreciate Hannah here. It says in verse 18, "So she went her way and she ate, and her face was no longer sad." So she had some confidence in what Eli had said. And she also had some confidence that the Lord had heard her prayer. That's what I deduce from that. And that the Lord would handle it. She had really received no promise yet that the Lord would answer the prayer the way she wanted him to. I mean, yes, Eli did say, "Go your way. May the Lord grant your request." But I don't get that. I don't really read that as a guarantee from Eli. Maybe it was. I'm not sure. But she was no longer sad. And I find that interesting that the prayer and the pouring of her heart out to God did comfort her and help her. And it's amazing that same thing happens to us when we will pour our soul out to the Lord as Hannah did. There is absolute comfort in that. Whether our prayers answered the way we want it to be or not, there's certainly comfort in that. So again, they rose early and worshiped before the Lord and returned and came to their house at Ramah. Again, so Ramah is mentioned there in verse 19. They go to Ramah, and Hannah later on conceives and she bears Samuel. And Samuel, the name Samuel, and really anytime you see a name that has L in it, you can count on that God is somewhere in that name. And so Samuel means heard by God or heard of God. And so she named him Samuel because God heard her prayer. And so the name reminded her that God had heard her prayer. So Elkanah, again, year after year, would go to Shiloh. And after Samuel was born, Hannah would not go with him. She would stay home with Samuel. And she did this until the child was weaned. And stayed home with him. And Elkanah supported her in that. Do what seems good to you, but you be sure, Elkanah said, that you keep the promise you've made to the Lord. So again, I think that's an admirable quality of Elkanah, and also very admirable of Hannah, because she made this vow to the Lord, and what did she do? Followed through with it. She kept it. She kept that vow. So after he had been weaned, she goes with Elkanah and brings three bulls, an ephah of flour, and a skin of wine, and she offered the sacrifice there with Eli. They slaughtered the bull and they brought the child to Eli. And Hannah reminded Eli, "Remember the woman that was praying that you thought was drunk? That's me, and this is the son that I was praying for." And so she left Samuel there, and she lent him to the Lord, and he was the Lord's, and she told him why she was leaving Samuel there. So weaning, again, doesn't mean the same thing as we think of weaning, because, you know, it would have been a toddler if it was just weaning no longer on the bottle or nursing. You know, that would just be a toddler that she was leaving there. But clearly, Samuel was old enough to help. Because it says, even though he was a child, so he was still a child, but not a toddler, not just in the way. And because even though he was a child, the text lets us know that he was ministering, he was serving there in the house of the Lord. So he was able to help Eli. I wouldn't say so. I wouldn't say so. You got an answer to that? Okay. Okay. All right. Good. Good. Yeah. Good. Good. So, yeah. I see others nodding, and I have to plead ignorance on that, but I see others nodding. So yeah, that's right, is what I'm hearing. Okay. So, anybody else want to put me on the spot? Show what I don't know? Good with that. But we learned something. Thank you, Charles. And thanks for the question, Freddie. Yeah. Yeah. So she was excused because the law did not require that. Okay, so Hannah prays in chapter 2 just a really beautiful, beautiful prayer. And the theme of the prayer, and we'll not take time to read the whole prayer. I trust that you've done that already in preparation. But the theme is the power and holiness and salvation of Jehovah. That's really the theme of the entire prayer. This is really a theme throughout the Bible, how that the proud are brought low and the humble are exalted. I mean, I couldn't count how many times we see that lesson taught in the Bible. Here in this prayer, I mean, throughout the book of Proverbs, throughout the book of Ecclesiastes, throughout the Psalms, throughout the New Testament, really, God wants the humble, and He promises to exalt the humble. So here is again another of that. And I get that there's a bit of a retort, if you will, to Peninnah's provocation. And notice in verse 5, this is what I'm getting at. Those who were full have hired themselves out for bread, and the hungry have ceased to hunger. Even the barren has borne 7. I take that as a reference to herself, because she was barren before Samuel. And she who has many children has become feeble. So I take that the tables have turned now between Hannah and Peninnah, and that's a reference to that. Now, have borne 7. How many children does Hannah have at this point? Okay, she has 6 eventually. Perhaps at the time of this prayer, she may have only had 1, right? But you're right, she did have 6 because the text explicitly mentions that she had 3 sons and 2 daughters, and then you add Samuel to that, she had 6. So I think seven, again, is that figurative term. And that even when she had Samuel, and I think that at this time that this prayer was offered, she probably only had Samuel at this time. And so she only had one. But she said, the barren has borne seven. So if the Lord had stopped with Samuel, and that would have been the only child she had, I take it that Hannah would have been content. Her prayer was answered. And she was thankful to God for that. That's how I read that. That the barren has borne seven. In other words, she's complete now. She's borne all that she's asked for. That's kind of how I take that. So just a beautiful, beautiful prayer. And then it closes out with, I think, a messianic reference there at the end. The adversary, verse 10, the adversaries of the Lord shall be broken in pieces. From heaven He will plunder against them. The Lord will judge the ends of the earth. He will give strength to His king and exalt the horn of His anointed. I think that's a messianic reference as best I can tell. Absolutely. Good. Yeah, very, very good point. Very good point. And throughout the Bible, and particularly the New Testament, the timing of the Messiah is something God had in mind all along. Yeah, so I think that it came at exactly the right time. So, yeah, absolutely. Very good. Very good comment. Very good thought. Very good. And so Elkanah went to his house, and Samuel stayed and ministered before Eli. So Eli's sons, Hophni and Phinehas, were very, very wicked. And we'll revisit that just a little bit later. They were very, very wicked. Actually, now's the time to talk about that. So the custom was, the priest would get boiled meat. So they would boil the meat, and after the fat had been boiled and the meat was boiling, they would put in a three-pronged flesh hook. And whatever came out on that flesh hook is what the priest would get to keep. But that's not how Hophni and Phinehas did things. They would go to those who were coming to worship God, and they would say, give us part of the sacrifice before you offer it to the Lord. Before you take the fat and burn it. And that was absolutely contrary to the law. The law was very specific in which parts of the animal were to be burned and to belong to the Lord. And they demanded that they give them part of that so that they could take and roast it. They even explicitly said, we will not accept boiled meat from you. We want it raw. We want it before you offer the sacrifice. And if you don't give it to us, we're going to take it by force. So very, very wicked they were. And it was so bad, and you can understand this, perhaps. It was so bad that people dreaded to go and offer sacrifices. And again, if someone were threatening you and taking from you and forcing you to violate what you knew the law said, it would be discouraging, to say the least. And the Lord, that's not lost on the Lord. He is not happy, and again, Eli is held responsible for this too, as well. We'll see that a little bit later on. That was where the house of the Lord was. And you're right. You had the option. Today we have the option of going somewhere else, or even starting our own work, right? And in those days, you went to the house of the Lord to do that. That was it. And so they were in a bind. And so again, what people were doing was not going. And so if the priests were this bad, if the spiritual leaders were this bad, what do you think the general spiritual condition was throughout Israel? And again, as they're avoiding worship because of the priests, it could only get worse. Do you see that? The only way I know of to strengthen faith is to keep God in front of you every day through His Word and you know, prayer and practicing it. And the people were afraid to do that. So they were definitely getting worse and worse. So it was that bad that men avoided. And meanwhile, Samuel ministers to the Lord at the tabernacle in Shiloh. And Hannah would make him a garment and bring it every year when they would come. So Elkanah continued to come yearly. And so Hannah would come and bring a garment. And the text says that Samuel wore a linen ephod, even though he was a child. So this concept of even though he was a child means that he was young, he was a child, but he was serving as a priest, helping the priest in the offering. And this garment that Hannah brought was not just a, you know, it wasn't just a change of clothes. It was something special and significant. And then Eli would bless Elkanah, saying, "Jehovah give you descendants from this woman." That's why I suggested that perhaps during the prayer she only had one. This comes a little later during the yearly visits. And I think that prayer was shortly after Samuel was left there. And again, Hannah had three other sons and two daughters, and Samuel grew before the Lord, verse 21. That he grew before the Lord. So let's get back to Eli, as the text does. Eli told his sons, so he rebukes them. He told his sons, "Look, I hear reports of you. It's not good that I hear. You're making the people of the Lord transgress. If a man sins against another man, then God can judge between them. But you're sinning against God. If someone sins against God, who will intercede for it?" So really, you know, sharply rebuking the people, or his sons. But did it make any difference? Not at all. Hophni and Phinehas, it did not make a difference. And even, they were even so bad as they were committing fornication with women there at the tabernacle who were serving. And it was just an awful, awful situation that Hophni and Phinehas were. And the text makes it clear that Eli is responsible for this. Okay? Now, that's not always the case. Sometimes children are bad, and it's not the parents' fault. The Bible teaches that would be the exception and not the rule. But in this case, the Lord holds Eli responsible for the deeds of Hophni and Phinehas, and on two levels. Later on, we're going to see that the text says that the reason the judgment comes on Eli's house is because he did not restrain his sons. Okay? Now, we're going to see what happens now is a man of God comes and visits Eli, a prophet, and rebukes him. And the point he makes is that Eli did not show the position of the priesthood the proper respect. Because Eli was judge in Israel. Eli was priest. And he allowed his sons to serve as priests, and he allowed his sons to pervert this. He knew of their behavior. He heard the reports of their behavior. So what option did Eli have that he didn't exercise? Take them away. Remove them. That was in his authority to do. Now, again, when children are grown, the text makes it clear Eli is responsible for them, their being in this, because he didn't restrain them. I take that mean he didn't raise them as he should. But when children are grown, what can you do, right? Right? He couldn't have made them suddenly be good now that they were grown. But what he could have done, and what he should have done, is to remove them from being priests. That was a very real option. And that may not have suddenly made Eli or Hophni and Phinehas be good people. But it would have eased the situation we talked about earlier of people being afraid because the priests were so corrupt. That was an option he had. Yes. Yeah, there should have been, beyond just being removed, there should have been much, much firmer and stricter punishment.
That's what the Lord hired.
Yeah. The Lord wanted to kill them. Yeah, the text says that in verse 25. Nevertheless, they did not heed the voice of their father because the Lord desired to kill them. And that's definitely, God wanted to kill them because, and don't get it in your mind that God just hated Hophni and Phinehas and He wanted to kill them. No. Hophni and Phinehas were deserving of death because of the things they had done. And because of the way they were treating the people, and the way they were leading the people astray, and the way they were taking from the people by force. They deserved to die. And the text says that Eli honored his sons more than God. And that is, those are hard, hard words. Hard words. But it is true in that what Eli, he did not do that. And the prophet tells them, this is how you know that these things are going to take place, and this is how you know that God is not happy with what you've done, that Hophni and Phinehas will die in the same day, And there will not be an old man in your house. Everybody in your house moving forward will die in their prime, is what the man of God tells him. And he also says that, verse 35, "Then I will raise up for myself a faithful priest who shall do according to what is in my heart and in my mind, and I will build him a sure house, and he shall walk before my anointed forever." Now catch what happens to Eli's descendants. "And it shall come to pass, everyone who is left in your house will come and bow down to him for a piece of silver and a morsel of bread and say, 'Please put me in the priestly positions that I may eat a piece of bread.'" So Eli's house is going to be begging this new priest for a job just so they can have a little bit to eat. So that's what's going to happen because Eli did not restrain his sons. Yes. Yes. That's correct. That is correct. That is correct. He said, "Indeed, your house and the house of your father would walk before me forever. But now, far be it from me." Yeah, that's absolutely true. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. One thing related to this, so what we're going to do is on Sunday, we're scheduled to go 4 through 8, and I'm going to cover that as well. But I wanted, while we're on this topic, I don't want to get into the word of the Lord coming to Samuel. I'd like to give that more than the 5 minutes we have left. But one thing I did want to point out is verse 13 of chapter 3. Because it's very much on topic of what we've been talking about here in these last few minutes. And this is what the Lord is speaking to Samuel. We'll get to the Lord coming to Samuel and talking to him next time in the story of that. A very beautiful story that needs a little more time than I have, and you should tell it to your children in a very lively way. But this part of it in verse 13, "For I have told him that I will judge his house forever." So the Lord tells Samuel that he's already told Eli he's going to judge his house forever. "For the iniquity which he knows, because his sons made themselves vile." And notice how he puts it back on Eli. "And he did not restrain them." Okay. So there's no question that the behavior of Eli's sons, Eli is responsible for that in the Lord's eyes. No question for that about that in my mind. Now, that's not always the case. But in this case with Eli, that's absolutely the case, that the Lord holds Eli responsible. We're not told all the details, but we are told that Eli is held responsible in the Lord's eyes for the behavior of his sons. All right. Any thoughts, questions, parting before we'll cover most of chapter 3 and go all the way through chapter 8 when Israel asks for a king on Sunday a week from today. Okay. All right, and Freddie has a schedule for next quarter. If anyone would like to have that for the foundations class, for you guys to teach with the dates and so forth. So anyone teaching, but the lessons, okay, and the number of lessons. So if anyone has, yeah. Okay, all right, right, yeah, good. Yeah, I had not made that connection back to Jephthah's daughter. Good. Anything else? All right, thanks for your attention this morning.